This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, Lorian Ann from If You See Something, Say Something, a group of artists who are angry with the MTA campaign to scare New Yorkers, are here to talk about their fight back.
Their posters are telling us to worry about Cheney, torture, and indefinite detention.
This month marks the third anniversary of the murder of Rachel Corrie in the occupied territories. Join us with a discussion with her parents, Craig and Cindy, and CCR attorney Maria LaHood as they discuss how they've been fighting back.
Hear how Israel has stymied any investigation of the murder of Rachel Corrie, how the U.S. has done nothing to help out, and how even in New York, a major important theater is unwilling to run a play involving Rachel's words.
Caroline Fredrickson of the ACLU would join us to discuss what's so wrong with the Patriot Act reauthorization that happened this month.
We could also entitle that segment, The Sun Never Sets on the Patriot Act.
We'll also discuss the Zacharias Moussaoui trial, which resumes today.
Government lawyers in the Moussaoui case have gone and coached witnesses in their efforts to make sure that Moussaoui gets the death penalty.
All that and more on today's Law and Disorder.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, President of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, Director of the USA Program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
There must be some way out of here, said the Joker to the thief. There's too much confusion, I can't get no relief. Businessmen,
as most people know, Zacharias Moussaoui is a French citizen of Moroccan descent who was arrested shortly before 9/11, I believe about 1 month before. He has been put on trial and has been sentenced and is facing possibly death or life in prison for not informing the federal government about the September 11th attacks. He was he pleaded guilty to conspiring with conspiring with Al-Qaeda to blow up or to drive planes into the World Trade Center.
So what we have now is really just the sentencing, and there's a jury for the sentencing phase.
Yes, there is.
And he can get the death penalty for that.
Yes. Right. Yes. What he said in his trial that, yes, he conspired with Al-Qaeda to fly planes into U.S. buildings, but he denied specific knowledge of the September 11th attacks. And what's really unfortunate about his trial and unfortunate for the U.S. system of justice is that he was unable to put on the witness stand Al-Qaeda member or alleged Al-Qaeda members who are in U.S. custody who could testify to the fact that he knew nothing or to his assertion that he knew nothing about the specific September 11th attacks.
Right. That was the first phase.
That was the first phase.
And the trial judge was reversed. She had actually said either he can't get the death penalty or he can't be tried unless he can get access to those witnesses. The government said, well, you can have a video or something like that. And that's what happened. So we're through that phase now.
They got some limited transcripts. But what transcripts do not allow is they don't allow a full, you know, the defense attorneys to fully question witnesses. And they don't allow, you know, they don't allow the opportunity for in-depth interviews.
So now we're at the penalty phase. And, you know, I read the article about what's been happening during the penalty phase. It's very hard to figure it out exactly. But, Dahlia, why don't you give us a little overview of the penalty phase.
Well, at the penalty phase, I think the choice is between the death penalty and life in prison. And that's what the jury is looking at. Should this person get life in prison or the death penalty? Early on in the trial, the judge, this is taking place in Northern Virginia, and it's a tough court. It's a tough district. And the judge said that all witnesses, prosecution witnesses, were not to be kept informed about what's going on in the trial.
They don't want the witnesses to tailor their testimony to what other people
have said. That's standard practice. You always make a motion to exclude witnesses, and they can only sit in the courtroom after they've testified. Right. They can't be there and shape their testimony from what they're hearing.
And this is for any witnesses, prosecution or defense. And what happened was a lawyer for
Well, before we get there, what's important to me is to understand what's the government's theory of the case. The government's theory of the case here is that he had information that could have stopped 9/11.
Yes.
And that he told them that 9/11 could have been prevented. His lawyers, Moussaoui's lawyers, I think, are saying they already had as much information as they were going to get out of Moussaoui, and therefore Moussaoui, whatever he said to them, didn't have the specific information and wasn't going to give them enough information to actually make a difference in 9/11. So the crucial thing for the government here is trying to demonstrate somehow that Moussaoui's information would have helped them prevent 9/11.
They want to get witnesses who are going to come forth and testify that he knew X, Y, and Z, and therefore he knew, and he should be executed.
They also want government witnesses, people in the FAA and TSA, to say, hey, listen, had we known this specific information that Moussaoui had, we would have been able to stop this.
A particular item, for example, had we known that they would be using short-handled knives or short blades, we would have looked for short blades. The defense is saying, you already were looking for short blades, so Moussaoui wouldn't have helped you at all. So the key evidence here is by the government witnesses to try and say, we wouldn't have looked for short blades, we weren't looking for short blades, but had Moussaoui told us, we would have. And that's where we get to the misconduct by the government attorneys. A little bit difficult to understand, but let's go to the misconduct because it is a complex issue.
Well, the misconduct is basically that the judge told the lawyers, listen, you don't bring your witnesses into the courtroom and you don't tell them what's going on in this courtroom and you don't coach them. These are pretty standard procedures. Well, one of the government attorneys, a government for the TSA, sent an email to 7 FAA witnesses, Federal Aviation Administration witnesses, who were due to testify. She not only told them what was going on in the courtroom, but she outlined the prosecutor's opening statement. It's like a roadmap of where the prosecutor wants to go and will go and who will testify and what they will say. She outlined that for them and gave them talking points, basically coaching them and telling them what to say on the stand. And this is a huge problem among lawyers. This is something you just never do. So it's pretty shocking she did this, especially in such a high-profile case. I was pretty surprised.
And what she actually did was she said, here are the problems in the case. The defense has done a great job on cross-examination, Moussaoui's lawyers, and they've been able to demonstrate that essentially that you didn't really need this information. So you have to testify how much you need this information. So they're really setting this up to kill this guy. That was what this was about. It's utter and complete misconduct by the attorney for the Federal Transportation Administration. She has now been relieved of her job, but it's a pretty remarkable.
She's not relieved of her job.
She's on administrative duty.
If this is crazy that she still has her job,
she should be disbarred. It's crazy that she still has a law license. You're absolutely right.
She should be disbarred. They disbar Lynn Stewart.
She's coaching witnesses to get a guy executed. Is this shocking? Well, let me tell you what Bill Kunstler had to say about stuff like this. After the Chicago 7 trial, which was the great conspiracy trial in the movement of the 60s, the anti-war movement, the black movement, the student movement, all the leaders were put on trial. Kunstler defended him. Michael Ratner actually wrote the brief when they sentenced Bill to 7 years for contempt of court. He won that case, too, Michael. Congratulations. But in any case,
well, the Center Bill for Constitutional says, Rights, all of us really worked on it.
Bill says, with respect to that trial in front of Judge Hoffman, he says, I learned that the government would stop at nothing, including subordination of perjury, fabrication of documents, eavesdropping on attorney-client conferences, and constant and vitriolic public denigration of both defendants and their counsel to carry the day. Then he says, after Chicago, which was my personal Rubicon, many of my friends and foes alike tried to convince me that what took place in Judge Hoffman's courtroom was simply aberrational and that I should not regard the entire legal system as villainous. At first blush, I was willing to consider this appraisal, but as time went by, I came to understand that in cases that worried or beset the establishment, no gutter was too low. I also became conscious of the sad fact that prosecutors and law enforcement agents on both the state and federal level would resort to any dirty trick, no matter how heinous, to do their master's bidding, as well as satisfy their own ambitions.
Now, one thing that's interesting about that statement by Bill and Chicago and how the government, when they want to get their guy, will do everything, including break the law, suborn perjury, etc., is the Massawi case also reminds me of the case of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. Julius and Ethel Rosenberg convicted of so-called giving the secret of the atom bomb.
Conspiring.
Conspiring to give the secret of the atom bomb to the Soviet Union are up for sentencing before Judge Kaufman, who's a district court judge. This is in the 1950s, a district court judge in the Southern District of New York. And what do they do but the Justice Department or people in the Attorney General's office meet privately with the judge or give him communications that essentially say, we want these people to get the death penalty, give them the death penalty. And this is privately and telling him how important it is for America going forward to get the death penalty for these people. Completely illegal, completely unauthorized, but they got away with it. And unfortunately, the Rosenbergs suffered the death penalty.
And they gave not only Julius the death penalty, but they gave his wife Ethel, who they knew at the time was completely innocent of this. They gave his wife Ethel the death penalty also, and they knowingly executed two parents who left behind two young children. And that courtroom that they convicted the Rosenbergs in to bring this conversation full circle, it's the same courtroom where they framed up and convicted Lynn Stewart last year.
Well, they said in this case, Ed McMahon, who's the attorney for Massawi, he said, you know, we should exclude the death penalty as an option now. And unfortunately, that didn't happen.
Right. That would have been actually the right ruling. I think what's important here to understand is this was a, you know, this is a so-called 20th hijacker case or whatever they want to call Massawi. But, you know, there's many of these terrorism cases across the country now. Some of them have actually been upended by government misconduct, the Detroit case for one example. And it indicates to me that in these cases, even though the government has every advantage, a time of fear, a time of alleged, you know, a time of Osama bin Laden, some secret resources, they still find it necessary to break the law in making sure that they convict the people they want to convict.
Fredrickson of the ACLU will join us to discuss what's so wrong with the Patriot Act reauthorization that happened this month. Caroline, what's so bad about this reauthorization of the Patriot Act?
Well, I think the members of Congress lost a fundamental opportunity to actually add back some accountability into the law. What we were looking for in the reauthorization of the Patriot Act was some very modest reforms, but that would require law enforcement at the federal level to actually demonstrate that there was some connection between the records that they're seeking and someone who is affiliated with a terrorist organization or a foreign power. And right now, this is pretty much of a blank check for them.
So what actually happened? It wasn't all of the Patriot Act that was up for reauthorization, but my understanding is that a portion of the Patriot Act was supposed, as they said, sunset.
Right. There were only the 16 provisions, and only a handful of those were actually controversial. Most groups like the ACLU and the others that were engaged, such as the American Conservative Union and a whole range of organizations from the right and left, focused on just a couple of different provisions. But the ones that were really critical were exactly the ones I described before, the ones where there was the missing element is the requirement that the FBI in particular have to show in some way that there's a connection between what they're seeking and some terrorist or foreign power that actually would show that there's some reason to turn over very sensitive personal records.
For those who don't know what those provisions are, can you explain them?
Sure. There's something that people might be aware of called Section 213, or the Library Records Provision. And the Library Records Provision is well known because it is the one that has allowed the FBI to actually get copies of what types of materials people are seeking or what kinds of internet searches they're doing at libraries.
Is this just at libraries?
The libraries are the ones that I think most people sort of gets them in their gut, in the sense that these people go to the library, they want to read about all sorts of different things. And if you go and you want to understand something about a foreign country, it shouldn't all of a sudden, you know, you shouldn't have your records looked at by the FBI.
Now, Carolyn, this is Michael speaking. Now, that's the one where the FBI has to go to a judge, but the judge has to sign the subpoena or whatever they call it.
Yes, in 213 they do, unlike the national security letter provision, which they can issue just on their own.
But let me see if I understand. There's the one for the library is called 213?
215.
215. And then there's a thing called the national security letter, which they issue on their own. Now, why couldn't they issue a national security letter to the library?
They could, and they do.
So they don't really have to use the one where they have to go to the judge. Is that right?
No, they don't. They have slightly different stipulations about what kind of records are covered. But the national security letter provision is actually another one of the major areas where there was a great deal of concern. And I think exactly as you said, there's no judicial oversight there at all.
So what happened to national security letters now that we're talking about them?
Well, very little, in fact. There was some slight modification. There's a gag order that's associated with receiving a national security letter. Say what happens is it gets sent to a company, say an ISP, an internet service provider, that they're told that they need to turn over all the internet search records that they have, just sort of a topical example, but they're gagged from telling any of their customers that they're actually turning over their search records.
And they're turning it over to who? The FBI?
They're turning it over to the FBI.
What would those records mean? You mean like all the email that goes through an ISP that I would send could go into the government just on the basis of a national security letter?
It's transactional, but with email, as you know, a lot of information is captured by the title.
So you mean like transactional, you mean the subject line and
subject lines and things like
that. And the to and from and all that kind of
stuff.
Exactly.
So at least technically they're not supposed to look at the rest of it. You know, we don't necessarily know the answer to that.
Well, what kind of standard does the FBI have to be held to in order to present a national security letter?
Well, you know, the standard is probable cause standard, but there's no review of that. And nor does the national security letter, similar to the 215 order, does not anymore require that there be a connection between the records sought and a terrorist. So imagine the breadth of that power that the FBI has, where without judicial review, they can issue a national security letter that encompasses a variety of financial transactional records. You know, say your car rental or your hotel stays or whether you gambled at a casino or not. And all of that can be turned over to the FBI, and the recipient of the national security letter is then gagged.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Caroline Fredrickson, National Legislative Director of the American Civil Liberties Union, talking to us about what's wrong with the reauthorization of the Patriot Act that happened this month.
Let me see if I get the standard business. What I think I understand about that is they could simply say they're doing a terrorist investigation of the World Trade Center, and they need information on Michael Ratner for that investigation. That's all they have to say, right?
Right. They have to say it's relevant
right.
to an ongoing investigation, and I guess
they don't have to prove any link between the person whose records they want and the particular investigation.
No, exactly. It just has to say it's relevant to an ongoing investigation, which, you know, what's not relevant?
Yeah, that's bad news.
So they can do whatever they want. And those two provisions that we're talking about, the library letters we're referring to colloquially, as well as the national security letter, those were supposed to sunset?
Well, not the national security letter provision,
uh-huh.
but the 215 section. Both of those had actually, the national security letter provision did not have a sunset in the past, but now does in this reauthorization. It's going to sunset in 4 years, as will this 215 section. I think in recognition that these were the most controversial sections of the act, the small cosmetic change that was agreed to before they passed the reauthorization bill.
But they, in 4 years, they can just shoot new life into them again like they did here.
Exactly.
So yeah. Was anything improved in this reauthorization? I mean, I know the ACLU worked very hard, the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, along with people all across the nation in a left-right coalition to state their opposition to the Patriot Act and so many of the rollbacks of civil liberties that were happening around the country. Is there anything in here that shows a responsiveness to that huge outpouring?
Well, not really. Unfortunately, I think, you know, that some people would suggest that there were improvements made. When you look closer at them, it's clear that they're really very cosmetic. It was a very important discussion to have, and I guess I want people to understand how significant it is when citizens get engaged and not be demoralized when you don't win the way you wanted to. But what
Absolutely.
There was, what I think was incredible, was that there was a filibuster of the Patriot Act 4 years after the Patriot Act was passed virtually unanimously through Congress. And even though it ended up being passed with some very modest changes being made, there was a huge and lengthy debate and a lot of anguish, I think, from members as they tried to wrestle with whether or not they could live with whatever they perceived political consequences to be of voting against something called the Patriot Act.
Yeah. Carolyn, what can people do at this point if they're concerned?
Well, they can raise their voices. They can continue to speak up to Congress. And let me just say that Senator Spector, who was the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, he had shepherded through a somewhat better authorization bill last summer through the Senate and then basically sort of threw in the towel in his debates with the House about what version, the House version or the Senate version, would emerge, and pretty much the House won. But immediately after the Patriot Act reauthorization passed, he introduced new legislation that would fix some of the provisions. So I think, you know, there's that out there. He recognized that the bill was flawed. A lot of members recognize that the bill was flawed and that more needs to be done. And so I think we'll continue to work on those issues, and we will continue to argue with the other side to show what are the real concerns for civil liberties here when you give the FBI this kind of unlimited power to look at people's private records. The issue's still alive. There is the sunset again, so hopefully we'll get some changes done before then, but if not, this is definitely going to be reopened at that point in time, and we need to continue to build and strengthen our voices.
I completely agree with you. I encourage people to go to ACLU.org for information, to educate yourself, and for an opportunity to engage in future action.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you, Carolyn.
Carolyn Fredrickson of the ACLU National Legislative Director. So pleased you were able to join us on Law and Disorder.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
We're delighted to have with us today two artist activists, part of a larger group, who are just fed up with the MTA's campaign, If You See Something, Say Something. Welcome, Anne and Lori, to Law and Disorder.
Hi.
Hi.
We're thrilled to have you here because, let me tell you, I can't even remember how many New Yorkers have been so irritated by the DHS signs, the government signs, up on the subways that say, if you see something, say something. And so I was thrilled when you guys approached us after our panel at Left 2006 and told us that you all had these postcards, these great postcards that really say a lot. Tell us about your project.
Well, the project is called If You See Something, Say Something, mimicking the MTA campaign. It consists of, you know, as the structure, the way a postcard is, there's an image and a text. Specifically, the images are images that would not have been seen in the mainstream media, or if they had been, had more quickly disappeared. One of which was the very first images of caskets coming back from Iraq that Tammy Cilicio took, which quickly disappeared. She actually got fired from her job, and they fired her husband. The other was one of the images of the initial detainees that were taken off, well, theoretically, from the battlefields in Afghanistan that went to Guantanamo Bay. There were five images. I don't even think those images ever made the mainstream media. Another one of the five images, another one is very briefly that you'll remember that large statue of Saddam Hussein that was toppled. Well, for about 5 minutes before it was toppled, there was an American flag that was placed over his head. Was that ever in the mainstream media? I'm not sure. There are American flags is the recurring theme in the postcards. There's another postcard has a picture of the American flag being sort of stuck up on a makeshift pole over a city street that looks like it's been completely demolished.
And what's the message you want to get out with these postcards?
The group felt that the sort of pervasive sort of intimidation or conjuring of fear within public space, everyday public space, if you see something, say something, campaign of the MTA is just one aspect of that. But, you know, we're told to be vigilant, don't trust your neighbor. You know, that was total information awareness. Remember briefly they wanted to get Con Ed people to, you know, utility workers, anyone who was entering private homes to look around and see. And so our idea was to take this, if you see something, say something, which is a very simple common phrase and is pervasive within the sort of public discourse and redirect it.
Every time I sit on the subway and I hear that announcement.
Laurie and Ann, these are really chilling postcards. Where can we get copies of them?
Well, we have an email, if you see something at gmail.com, and then you could...
Say that again, because our listeners want to get a pencil. Write this down. These are really some amazing postcards. Say that again, please.
The email address is if you see something at gmail.com, and we will answer any of your requests.
You can also ride the subway system.
And when we do, what do we do? Ann and Laurie, you brought in this great, if you see something, say something, a poster, which has got a couple of nice nuggets. A president of the United States authorizes illegal wiretaps. A secretary of defense orders the use of chemical weapons on the people of Iraq. A vice president schemes to wage war and then secretly profits and so on and so on. What's this all about?
Well, what occurred to me one day sitting on the train was the great irony of the MTA's If You See Something, Say Something campaign, because as they were trying to promote public vigilance and suspicion in the public domain, I was watching people read the newspapers. And in the newspapers, we're seeing things every day that we actually should be vigilant about and suspicious that are happening in the White House. And I just thought we should start to tell people what really is happening that they should pay attention to. So that's what, you know, provoked me to illustrate the irony by using their words and their slogan and actually pointing to the people, the real suspects.
Is there someplace online people can see these images and the posters?
Or order them?
No, we just have the email address. Our action has been building up to a full-day event, which is going to take place on Monday, which is
today.
The first day of year four of the war in Iraq. And we're going to be doing an action. We'll be on the street all day handing out postcards. We're starting at 10 a.m. From 10 to 11:30, we'll be in front of the UN. We have two large banners, one of which says, "No allegiance to war, torture, and lies." We're going to the stock exchange. We'll be there till 1. At 1 o'clock, we're going to the World Trade Center. We'll be there for a couple hours. And at 4 o'clock, we'll be up at Times Square. And we're spending the entire day with the banners and handing out postcards. So I guess that answers your question before. Where can people get these postcards? Well,
today they'll be available.
Thank you.
Since September of 2000, almost 5,000 Palestinian homes have been demolished by the Israelis. This practice of house demolitions is part of a land grab by the Israeli government and an effort to force ordinary Palestinians out of their homes and out of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Rachel was one of many unarmed peace activists trying to prevent the demolition of innocent Palestinians' homes when she was killed by an Israeli bulldozer manned by two soldiers. Eyewitness Tom Dale was there, and he reported Rachel was with other human rights observers when she was monitoring one of two bulldozers in the area that day, and one turned towards her. In his words, he says, Rachel knelt down in its way. She was 10 to 20 meters in front of the bulldozer, clearly visible, directly in its view. The two drivers in the cab were in radio contact with an IDF tank, that's an Israeli military tank, that had a profile view of the situation. There is no way she could not have been seen by them in the elevated cabin. They knew where she was, there is no doubt. The bulldozer drove slowly towards Rachel, gathering earth in its scoop as it went. She knelt there. She did not move. The bulldozer reached her and she began to stand up, climbing the mound of earth. She slipped down, turning as she went. The bulldozer pushed Rachel, first beneath the scoop, then beneath the blade, then continued till her body was beneath the cockpit. They waited over her for a few seconds before reversing with the blade pressed down, so it scraped over her body a second time. She died in the ambulance a few minutes later of massive internal injuries. Here we'll play for you a segment of the documentary, The Gaza Killings.
2 days before our visit, a protester had been killed. Rachel Corey was the first American to be killed in Gaza.
She was at eye level with the driver of the bulldozer. She was up, her head and upper torso were actually above the blade of the bulldozer. So he could very clearly see that she was there, her in her orange fluorescent jacket that she was wearing. But instead of stopping at this point, he continued forward, which buried her legs and pulled her legs down. And as she got pulled down, she was pulled out of view of the bulldozer driver. And if he had stopped at this point, he may have only just broken her legs. But he continued forward anyway until she was sucked all the way underneath the bulldozer.
So there's a number of things we want to talk about today, but I guess the first thing is, I know this is the third anniversary of Rachel's death. And I know there were events all across the country, and I'm just interested in how you see, you know, the issue about whether there's been any serious investigation of her murder in Israel or in the United States, and how you see the future going forward in terms of both investigating that murder as well as the issues that Rachel was involved in protesting.
I think people are aware that there was an Israeli military investigation that occurred in 2003. Our government, actually, when that was completed, the Israeli government refused to release the report of it to the U.S. government. Subsequently, two people from the American Embassy were able to read it. Craig and I were eventually able to read it. The U.S. government is, its position, its stated position to us through a letter from Larry Wilkerson, who is the chief of staff, was the chief of staff to Colin Powell, and reiterated by State Department officials at a human rights hearing before Congress last year, is that the report that they read did not reflect an investigation that was thorough, credible, and transparent. So we continue to ask the U.S. government to make sure that we get that somehow. That has taken our family members, in fact, this week, took our family members back to the halls of Congress again after 3 years, still walking the halls of Congress, asking for an independent U.S. investigation. We know now that there is a small piece of U.S. law under which a U.S. investigation could occur. We have heard directly from the U.S. attorney, actually, in Seattle. We finally got a contact in the Justice Department last year after 2 years, and we were told by the U.S. attorney in Seattle that even under this statute, we would not get an investigation because actual prosecution requires certification by the U.S. Attorney General. And we were told in that meeting that no U.S. Attorney General, past, present, or future, would ever sign a certification like this against Israel.
Why is that?
I asked I mean, I asked them, I said, is this, because they told us no other reason why it couldn't happen. And I said, you're telling me that it's because it's Israel? And the people in Seattle said, yes. And I think that they were really just trying to describe to us what the situation is, because at the same time, actually, an investigation under this statute happening for Rick Spear, who was killed in Indonesia, and the Indonesian military was implicated. We know that FBI have been in Indonesia investigating and so forth. Subsequently, we shared what the U.S. attorney in Seattle had told us with my daughter Sarah. Worked really hard in conversations with them, and we finally got a contact in the U.S. Justice Department. They were very upset by what the people in Seattle said, as were people in the U.S. Congress that we shared that information with. The U.S. the Justice Department official in D.C. told us that it wasn't true, that something could happen with Israel, with the government of Israel, and that he was interested in looking at what evidence is there, but we have no idea, no way of knowing how, if anything, has moved along on that. Now, what we have done in our work in Congress has been to pursue some support from the Judiciary Committee and from, actually, from our senators as well, and they have sent a letter. Maria Cantwell, Patty Murray, Senator Leahy, also the Iowa Senators Grassley and Harkin. Senator Grassley's on the Judiciary Committee, and we have ties to Iowa. We have family there. We understand that Senator Spector may send his own letter. And what they're asking is, they're asking justice if an investigation can take place. If it can't, they want to know why not. So there is work that continues to happen.
Now, is there anything our listeners can do in terms of, are there congresspeople, senators they should write to?
I believe pretty strongly that people, if they just contact their representative and their senators and say, it's been 3 years, the State Department is on record saying that the investigation hasn't been adequate. And we know that there is a piece of law under which investigation could happen. More needs to be done. And the message, I actually felt bad because my sisters, two sisters, and my daughter, Sarah, were in D.C. having some somewhat frustrating meetings and tired in a hotel room. And I thought of them there 3 years after Rachel's killing, and I thought it's outrageous that this is still what our family has to be doing.
It is really sad.
I think if people can send that message to their senators and to their representatives, that would be very helpful.
I mean, it's such an amazing outrage, because here you had Wilkerson himself, when he was working for Powell, say that the investigation was just inadequate.
Unfortunately, he also said that there was nothing that could be done. And, of course, now we know that there is statutory law under which the U.S. could proceed with an, well, with an investigation and then actually a prosecution. But for a prosecution, as Cindy said, the Attorney General has to certify that it appears that Rachel's death might have been part of an attempt to intimidate, coerce, or retaliate against another government or civilian population. And I think there's a lot of evidence that that's the case. But it's also true that that's not necessary to investigate, because, of course, how could you find that out unless you did a thorough investigation? That really is the point we're at, is asking for an investigation. And we've also, of course, gone to Israel. Our daughter Sarah wrote a letter to Prime Minister Sharon asking for their cooperation with such an investigation, also asking for their military to turn over whatever evidence that they have about what happened to Rachel. We've instituted a lawsuit in Israel, largely simply because as part of that lawsuit, you would have a right to depose and gather information, and we should have a right to, again, get the information that the other side has to that. Of course, since we filed that lawsuit, the Knesset has passed a law saying that nobody can sue who is harmed in an area of conflict.
And really? Wow. Right, I didn't know that at all. That's remarkable. So does that mean it's the end of your lawsuit? Or are you challenging the legality?
Well, it's not been thrown out of court yet. There would be appeals around that. And, of course, it's very strange because, for one thing, it's retroactive and includes anything that's happened since the fall of 2000. Of course, it have much more impact on Palestinians than, they're relatively few internationals that occurred there. So that's a challenge right there. And then just the whole idea of it. I think that from a human rights standpoint and from sort of a normal standpoint, of course, when we all want to lessen the violence that's in that's going on in the area. And it seems to me that when you take away the voice of the people, when you take away nonviolent means for redressing the grievances that they have and the severe sort of oppression that people are under, then if you don't support the nonviolent means for opposing that, then you have to ask yourself, what are you supporting? Because I've done, in business world and stuff, I've done a fair amount of bargaining with people. You really can't ask folks successfully to do something you wouldn't do yourself. And I think most Americans would not allow their homes to be destroyed, their croplands to be taken, their children to be killed, and not do something about that, not have some sort of action, redress. I don't think you can just ask people to look at that, or our family to look at Rachel as roadkill.
To hear that, I didn't even know that, and I've been following the case pretty closely. So we have now, you have the congressional efforts at an investigation or to get the administration to do something. We have the Israeli suit, and then I know we have Maria LaHood on the phone from the Center for Constitutional Rights, who's working with you, Cindy and Craig, in terms of a lawsuit against Caterpillar.
Yeah, the Corys have a lawsuit here in the U.S. against Caterpillar for aiding and abetting the war crimes that committed by the Israeli government. Caterpillar has been providing D9 and D10 bulldozers to the IDF for years, knowing they're used to demolish Palestinians' homes in violation of international law. So this case is an effort to hold Caterpillar accountable for that.
Those are huge bulldozers, right? I mean,
they're I don't know what, 60, 70 tons. They're militarized. They're
65 tons.
Yeah, 65 tons. Much bigger than the sort of average bulldozer we see on a daily basis.
And Maria, what stage is the lawsuit in against Caterpillar?
Unfortunately, the case was dismissed by the judge in November of last year without any oral argument, a short, poorly reasoned opinion, which we're appealing, and the appeal brief is actually due on Monday.
Oh, so you must be working pretty hard. But I know it includes Rachel's family as well as some Palestinians, is that right?
Right. It's also brought on behalf of 10 Palestinians who were killed and 6 who were injured when their homes were actually demolished on top of them, and they were killed, a few of them in the middle of the night, and then others actually had physical disabilities, which prevented them from getting out of the house.
For listeners for whom house demolition sounds completely foreign, can you please explain how it works?
Well, there are really different kinds of house demolitions that have occurred, and these have been going on for years and years. Where Rachel was in Rafah, it's primarily clearing demolitions that happen. The Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions has put out information about this, and I believe their figures are that roughly 60% of the demolitions that occur are clearing demolitions. This is, in Rafah, it was to clear a wide border strip where a steel wall was going in on Palestinian land, but along the border with Egypt. And Craig and I have been there and seen it with our own eyes. We actually were there before the house that Rachel died in front of was destroyed. Now that house has been demolished. But this is mass clearing of homes. Human Rights Watch stated that between September 2000 and 2004, or September or October, I think, one-tenth of the population of Rafah lost their homes. That was, I think, over 1,600 homes were destroyed. So this is massive clearing of homes, really indiscriminate clearing of homes. In our press, we tend, I noticed that in AP articles about housing demolitions, there would always be a sentence that said this was the policy of the Israeli government to destroy the homes of those who had committed suicide bombings or violence against Israelis somehow. Those are called punitive demolitions. According to the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, only 10% of demolitions fall into that category. I would point out that those are still violations of international law. They are human rights abuses. Just as if a member of our family committed a crime, we wouldn't expect that a government or a military could come in and take down our house and destroy the home of many other family members. But that's what happens in those situations. But it's only 10% that are punitive demolitions.
I think I'd like to point out here, if I could just take a second, that we see on blogs and sometimes get questions about Rachel standing and protecting the home of terrorists or something. And, of course, the family was, they were behind the wall that Rachel was in front of. But also since then, three members of that family. Actually, the baby wasn't alive at that time. She was born afterwards. But Khalid Nasrallah and his wife Samah and their baby Sama have come to the United States and gone on tour here. Well, to do that, you have to go to Tel Aviv to get a visa from the United States. And to go to Tel Aviv, you have to have a visa from Israel. Israel, after they destroyed the home of this family, had no problem with the family walking the streets of Tel Aviv and coming to the U.S. Embassy to get a permit. And the United States has no problem with that family walking the streets of L.A. To me, that says a whole lot, that they destroyed the home of a family who they feel perfectly safe if that family is in Tel Aviv or L.A.
Yeah, there's no comprehension in this country that these are ordinary, everyday people who wake up. By the end of the day, their home is demolished sometimes on top of them. I had a 95-year-old woman crying in my arms in front of the rubble of her home. She had done nothing to deserve this, and neither had anybody else, and it just happens as a matter of routine. I think a lot of it is part of a land grab that has become policy in Israel. I wanted to ask you both about the play. Here in New York City, the play was supposed to go on, I Am Rachel Corrie, and that was canceled. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
The play was developed by the Royal Court Theater, actually by the actor Alan Rickman and Catherine Viner, who writes for The Guardian. It's all drawn from Rachel's words, from her writing. However, what happened initially was that a friend of Alan Rickman's read Rachel's emails from Gaza when they were printed really in their entirety in The Guardian after she was killed. And when Alan Rickman read them, he thought to himself that something needed to be done with them. And he had worked with the Royal Court Theater, which has a wonderful reputation, works with new writers and international writers. He took the material to them, and then they approached us really quite quickly and very gently about the possibility of doing some kind of theater work with the material. It took us a long while as a family to kind of get it together and to respond. We actually went in September 2003. Craig and I met with some people at the Royal Court. It was when we traveled through London to visit Tom Herndahl, who eventually died from wounds being shot on the same border where Rachel was killed. And we visited him and his family. And during that trip, my sisters, who were really helping with the email, set up an appointment with the Royal Court. The script is drawn from Rachel's words. It is edited by Alan Rickman and Catherine Viner. It had two very successful runs in London, where it was just put forth as a piece of theater. In April of 2005, was in their upstairs theater, which is a small, intimate place. That's where Craig and I first saw it. It played to sell-out audiences. It got rave reviews. In October, they brought it back to their large theater and, again, had sold-out houses. We saw it again there. And it's a chance for Rachel, really, to sort of share something of who she was as a human being through her own words and through this wonderful performance by Megan Dodds, the actress. And it's a one-woman show. It starts in Olympia, and it takes people to Gaza and moves. And I think people see kind of how Rachel transitioned from Olympia to Gaza. People leave in silence, very thoughtfully, I think. So this was set to go, and then very abruptly was stopped. For us, of course, it was very sad when we heard that news. We were very disappointed.
What reason did they give?
The reasons have kind of changed, I think, as the New York Theater Workshop has had some time, you know, to try to get their version of things out there. But initially, the artistic director, James Nicola, the first quotes that we saw, and nobody's really disputed those, was that they had consulted with, they actually said, with parts of the Jewish community in New York, and thought it was too sensitive a time. They told the Royal Court, actually they called it a postponement, but they were talking about a year, a wait of a year before it would be done again.
This is Michael Ratner. Those are the first quotes I read as well. were basically that they had consulted with somebody in the Jewish community or some groups who said that they shouldn't do it or something like that.
Which was very, you know, my question immediately was, which part of the Jewish community did they speak with? Because we have so much support from the Jewish community throughout this country and in New York as well. I knew that if they'd gone to Jews Against the Occupation and many other organizations, that they would have heard something very different from than they did from whomever they talked to. And I don't know who they talked to. And I can't really speak for them. I have a lot of, in some ways, a great deal of empathy for the New York Theater Workshop. I have a feeling, but I have a lot of concern. I have deep concern about what's happened here. I think that it is a reflection of what happens around this issue in a lot of other ways in this country in terms of silencing and intimidating people who take a stand on the position. Or to demonize, which has happened in Rachel's case. And I think that's really counterproductive to those who want to find a just and endurable solution to this terrible tragedy. And I think it's very damaging to us as Americans. Our foreign policy is all tied up with this. Billions of dollars are being spent, and yet we can't have a play come that addresses some aspect. You know, it's not even just about this, but we can't have a play in New York.
It's caused a huge stink in New York, and I think there's some other theaters coming forward who say they're glad and willing to do the play, so hopefully.
I think there are any number of theaters that would be willing to do the play, and in many of them in New York. But I guess it troubles me a little bit that there were mistakes made with the New York Theater Workshop instead of just trusting Rachel and her words and putting on a play and letting Rachel speak for herself, that they felt like the need to somehow go out and in fact politicized it themselves. I remember Cindy telling me, and I didn't meet the couple, but when Cindy went back to, when we all went back to London this fall, when we first got into the theater, we were there too late to see the play that night, but Alan Rickman introduced Cindy to a couple from Israel, and they said that they identified themselves with a Likud party, so that's the far right in Israel. And they come to London on a holiday, wanted to see a play, and saw in the paper that My Name is Rachel Corrie was selected as the pick of the week by critics. And so they said, well, it has to do with Israel, and we should see it. And they said they loved it. And they said it's not against Israel, it's against violence.
And we hope that the rest of New York will have the opportunity to experience that same thing. Cindy and Craig Corrie, parents of Rachel Corrie, the unarmed peace activist who was killed 3 years ago this week, and Maria LaHood, their attorney in the Caterpillar lawsuit at CCR. Thank you for joining us on Law and Disorder. We encourage all our listeners to go to lawanddisorder.org.
And I would encourage people to go to Rachel's words to hear about what's going to happen.
Yeah, why don't you tell us? The date is, I think, Wednesday?
It's Wednesday, March 22nd at Riverside Church in New York City. And we will be there, but also many others who have step forward to come out and to respond to the fact that the play will not be opening next.
Yeah, that's at 7:30 in the evening.
Well, thank you very much, and really from all of us, just a big hug of support on your amazing struggle to get justice for Rachel.
Thank you all.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. Law and Disorder is produced by Jeff Brady. The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.